All right, so this is Bio 241. Had to turn the microphone on. And it's Thursday, the 19th. We're finishing up chapter 1, moving on to chapter 2 today. And we were just got done talking about some signaling molecules. Some of those are exam figures that you have to memorize. Make sure you know what an autocrine agent is, a neurotransmitter, neurohormone, and how they behave differently in the body, what kind of tissue secretes it, and what kind of tissue can sense a particular signaling molecule. Target tissue has to have what in order to be sensitive to a signaling molecule? It's got to have a receptor, right? It's got to have a receptor. All right, so the concept of homeostasis is kind of funny, a little bit maybe hard to understand right at the beginning, because we all know that our internal environment is different than the external environment. And we think of our body temperature should be at 98.6, but in reality, it can actually fluctuate a little, right? So the concept of homeostasis is how everything changes, all these physiologic parameters change, and just a little bit, so that nothing changes a lot. It doesn't mean that all these different parameters have to be absolutely constant, but they can vary up and down, but the range within they vary up and down has to be within what we call a normal range. Here's the cursor. Okay, so it's not a state of absolute constancy, it's a state of what we say dynamic constancy, right? In which condition are stabilized above or below a physiologic set point. So this set point is an absolute, just single value, but you can still have, you still can be normal, right, if you go above or below the set point, but not beyond the normal range. And the thing that maintains this normal range right here is through the use of feedback mechanisms or feedback loops. And in particular, there are a couple kinds of feedback loops, right? There's positive and negative. And in lab, what kind of feedback loop is going to maintain a physiologic parameter within a normal range? Is it going to be a positive feedback or a negative feedback mechanism? It's always going to be a negative feedback mechanism. Now, that doesn't, I don't mean to say that there are never any important positive feedback mechanisms that occur in our lives, but they only occur for a short period of time, right? And then they switch back to a negative feedback loop to maintain homeostasis. Okay, so in feedback loops, sorry, that arrow is disappearing on me. In feedback loops, right, you always start with a change in some kind of parameter, and in order for you to detect that change of some physiologic parameter, there has to be a sensor involved. If you don't have a sensor, then you can't be aware of that particular modality of energy, right? So, for instance, if we turn the lights off in here and turn them back on, in order for you to tell that the lights go on and off, what do you have to have? Eyes that function fairly well, right? And the same thing for all these other kinds of parameters. For instance, when pH is changing inside your body, there has to be sensors that can measure the acidity inside your body. Or if your blood pressure changes, there have to be pressure sensors inside your body that can measure those changes. And what do we call pressure sensors in your body? They're baroreceptors. You'll run into that in lab quite a bit. Baroreceptors, and it's kind of named after the person that studied pressure, right? Mr. Barr, and a lot of things were named after him, like barometric pressure, and the unit of measuring pressure is a bar as well. Okay, and then that information has to be sent to the integration center, and it gets to that integration center via an afferent pathway. And this integration center right here compares the value of some parameter to the set point, and if the value of that parameter equals the set point, then the integration center doesn't have to do anything because everything is absolutely perfect. But if there is an error in the physiologic parameter compared to the set point, then this integration center has to make a decision on what to do, right, to bring that parameter back to or to keep it within that normal range. So it sends a signal out via efferent pathway to an effector, and that effector makes some kind of change in the body, which then subtracts from the stimulus. And since it subtracts from the stimulus, we call that a negative feedback loop, right? So a negative feedback loop is the loop that normally maintains you in a disease-free state, so it's a good thing, even though we say negative. It's negative because why? Because it subtracts from the stimulus, all right? And then that brings that parameter back down to normal right here. Now, what kind of are the three kinds of effectors that you have in your body?
Glands.
Muscle. Oh, yes. What kind of muscle? Skeletal muscle. And then you could consider visceral muscle, like smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. So those are the three kinds of effectors that your system can work with. Okay, so here is a really nice illustration. This is not in your book, right, of a typical kind of response loop. And this is what your quiz is on in lab today. A response loop always starts with what? A stimulus. And it always ends with a response, right? So once again, a change in some kind of parameter, okay, is picked up, the stimulus stimulates a receptor or a sensor, and that information is sent via an afferent pathway to the integration center. And in most places or most response loops in your body, where is the integration center located? Okay, that's in your brain. I didn't tell you that. I don't know if anyone told you that in lab yet, but that means you were reading the book because it says that in the book. That's important. It's in the brain. From some low-level kinds of responses, we can have it anywhere in the central nervous system, including the spinal cord. So a lot of decisions can be made by the spinal cord without your immediate conscious awareness of it. And that signal then is compared with the set point. Right, so that's the analysis part. And if there is an error between those two signals, then the integration center has to make a decision and sends that decision out through the efferent pathway to an effector, which produces a response. And in this diagram right here, this is kind of a simple feedback loop, because remember, this response can feed back in two different ways. What are the two ways that it can feed back to the stimulus? Positive or negative. If it's negative, it will subtract from the stimulus, bringing that parameter back down toward the set point. But if it's a positive feedback loop, then it will add to the stimulus and drive the system farther and farther away from the set point. And under most circumstances, that's a fairly important disease state to consider, right? Because you don't want to drive your physiologic parameters far away from the set point. All right, so make sure you can answer these questions. All right, the kinds of feedback, you got negative and positive. We went over that pretty well, but here is just the some statements that talk about that. All right, so negative feedback is just any kind of body mechanism by which a change from an ideal normal value is made smaller or is resisted. All right, negative feedback leads to a compensated, healthy, disease-free state that maintains homeostasis. And the response then subtracts from the stimulus, moving the system back toward the set point. Positive feedback, on the other hand, is a body mechanism when there's a change from an ideal normal value is made greater. Positive feedback leads to a decompensated state usually, right? And it's a disease state away from homeostasis. So it's the job of medicine basically to bring people's systems back to within the normal range, maintaining homeostasis. So the response adds to the stimulus. Okay. So regulatory mechanisms, when we in this class start to look at them, can be of a couple different kinds. There can be intrinsic regulatory mechanisms where control is built into the organ that is being regulated. A pretty good example of this is the Frank-Starling law of the heart. So we'll pay close attention to this when we get to the heart chapter. It's going to be a couple months down the road. But one nice thing about the heart is that when more blood, for whatever reason, maybe all of a sudden you drank, you know, half a gallon of tea or something and your blood volume really expanded and a lot of blood is returning to the heart, so the heart has to work harder to pump all the blood that's returning to it. Well, it's very nice. As the heart starts to stretch, it actually gets stronger. So as we present more work for the heart to do, it stretches out and the heart gets stronger so that it indeed can pump that blood to the rest of your body. It doesn't get stuck in the heart. All right. Furthermore, if blood is not returning to the heart and the heart doesn't stretch as much, there's not as much blood in the heart, and so the heart adjusts and it gets a little bit weaker as a result of that. So it doesn't have to pump with the same kind of vigor. So the heart can adjust itself, right? It can adjust its contractile properties, the strength of contraction, depending on the workload that the body is demanding of it. Okay? So, and that's intrinsic to the heart. And you're aware that the heart can make all kinds of adjustments, maybe as a result of input from the nervous system, right? And that would not be intrinsic. If the heart is being adjusted by the sympathetic or parasympathetic nervous system, then that's what we would call extrinsic control. But the heart has both kinds. It has intrinsic and extrinsic as well. All right, so here is another example of extrinsic control, which comes from outside the organ. For instance, when body temperature is controlled by antagonistic effects of sweating and shivering. And in lab, you'll see something about antagonism. This is probably the most important concept that you can become familiar with in this course, because antagonism, well, in general, what's the connotation of antagonism to you if you weren't in a science or physiology or anatomy class? Yeah, it would mean that, you know, you don't ever want to be around antagonistic people all the time, right? But in terms of control systems, antagonistic control provides for two real important things, and that is precise control and balance. Precise control and balance, that's very important. So in terms of the musculoskeletal system in anatomy, you learned in terms of controlling your hand or your finger, all right, what muscles are antagonistic to each other, and why is that a really good thing? All right, so here you have your fingertip. And maybe tomorrow night, that person that's all dressed up in the fancy blue uniform and the badge and the sidearm might pull you over to the side of the road and say, okay, with your eyes closed, put your fingertip right on the tip of your nose like that. All right, and you got to do that, a common sobriety test. And if you're not inebriated, okay, then you can do that. But if you're drunk, you're going to have a really hard time doing that because you've lost that antagonistic control provided by what two muscles? The triceps, which extend, and the bicep that flexes. These two have to work together to give you precise control over your fingertip. If you didn't have antagonistic control, if you only had the biceps working, as soon as it contracted, what would happen? Oh, you'd knock the pencil out of the officer's hand or poke yourself in the eye or something, right? That wouldn't work very well. So antagonism is a really important concept for physiology. That's just the musculoskeletal system. We'll use that to understand many systems in the body during the semester. And here is our first example of antagonistic control. Oh, but let me think of another example of antagonistic control. Your automobile. Why do you have precise control and balance over your automobile? Yeah, you have the gas pedal and the brake pedal, or the accelerator and the brake, and you wouldn't even dream of driving your car without both of those. Even though they work in opposition to each other, if you have both operating, you have precise control over your vehicle. Okay, and when we say balanced in our bodies and even in the car, but most people don't drive like this, but sometimes people, you ever drive down the road and you see somebody's brake lights are on all the time? They have their foot both on the accelerator and the brake pedal at the same time. Now, what does that do? What does that do to the car? What does pressing the brake and the gas at the same time do? It cancels each other out, right? So that's important in physiology, because if there is noise in the accelerator and the brake, the same amount of noise being applied to both, when they're added together, what happens to that noise signal? It cancels out. It disappears. And that's what we mean by balance. So precise control and balance. So in this particular system right here, here we see the set point, 37 degrees. And your body temperature can increase maybe with exercise of some kind. And then the hypothalamus has receptors for body temperature. It knows it's increasing. And the hypothalamus is the integration center and makes a decision to bring your body temperature back down toward the set point. So it sends signals out to sweat glands to sweat, so that when water evaporates off your body, that cools you down. And if you get too cold, the hypothalamus then makes a different decision on what to do, right? It operates by stimulating muscles to contract and relax very quickly. That produces heat. So this is extrinsic control, because the hypothalamus itself can't make adjustments. It has to recruit other organs in the body, namely muscles to heat the body up and glands to cool the body down, right? So that's why we call that extrinsic regulation. The hypothalamus can't do that at all by itself. So what type of feedback is operating in this above example right here? Yeah, nice negative feedback, right? All right, so your body temperature is not absolutely, oh, I know what I'm doing wrong. Okay, hold on. Pointer options, arrow options, visible. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so so notice that your body temperature is not absolutely constant. What's it doing? It's going up a little bit, going down a little bit, going up a little bit, and going down a little bit. Another very important physiologic parameter in your body is water balance. The amount of water, you can't get dehydrated, you can't get overhydrated. So there are control mechanisms to adjust the concentrations of salt in your body, and partly that's done by regulating water, right? So in this particular circumstance, right, as you become heated up, what happens to the water balance inside your body? It gets disturbed a little bit. You start to perspire, so you start to lose water, okay? And so your water balance goes out of homeostasis a little bit, okay, because you need that water to sweat. But as you lose water, your body temperature comes back down, and then there are other systems like your kidneys that go and withdraw water out of the kidney tubule to maintain your water balance. So everything is changing all the time. Water balance is changing all the time. Salt concentration, glucose concentration, blood pressure, pH, all these parameters are changing. But how are they changing? Just a little bit at a time, right, within the normal range. And so that's what homeostasis is. I kind of think of Star Trek episodes way, way back. Probably some of you have seen them. I don't know. They're not released much anymore. But what was the name of the doctor in the original Star Trek? Yeah, Bones, right? And somebody, when they got sick, they were taken to the infirmary and placed on the table, and they had a really cool monitor at the head of the table, okay, with about five or six lines on it, and there was an arrow, okay, for each of these different parameters. And what were all these arrows doing? They were bouncing around all the time, right? And that's really a good thing. All of your body systems should be changing and adjusting, compensating for variations in other body compartments or other parameters, okay? And then when the patient died, what happened to all these arrows that were bouncing around? Oh, they just flatlined. They all dropped to the bottom. That's bad. So constancy is actually kind of bad, but having these parameters all bounce around each other, that's a very good thing. That's what's maintaining homeostasis. So when I think of homeostasis, I kind of think of it as a dance of physiologic parameters. All these parameters are dancing around each other. They are all changing a little bit so that nothing has to change a lot. So that's kind of a wordy description of homeostasis, but I like that description a lot. Okay. Here is an example of extrinsic control. We see a graph of glucose concentration in the blood versus time. And probably you all know that blood glucose is maintained within a fairly narrow range to promote life. And sometimes an individual cannot regulate their blood glucose concentration. What do we call that condition? Yes, diabetes mellitus in particular. Okay. So here we have a nice blood glucose, normal blood glucose concentration, and you're familiar with a hormone called insulin, and we're going to be really familiar with that hormone by the time we end this class. Insulin is a passport. It allows cells in the body to take glucose from the blood, all right? And as cells take up glucose from the blood, what happens to the concentration of glucose in the blood? For instance, if you have five $20 bills in your wallet and I take two of them out, what do you got left? You have more or less? Well, you got less, right? The same thing for glucose in the blood. If I'm a cell and I take glucose because I need it to stay alive, then the concentration of glucose in the blood drops as a result of that. So insulin decreases blood glucose concentration. And usually in a normal individual, insulin is secreted from the pancreas when you're in a fed state after a meal. And then cells can take glucose up because after a meal, your blood glucose goes up. Insulin is secreted, brings it back down to normal. Well, let's look at this little test that was performed on somebody. Here is normal blood glucose, but at this point in time right here, somebody was given an injection of insulin. And what does insulin do again? It allows cells to take up glucose, and probably what you're familiar with then is then insulin causes a decrease in blood glucose because cells can take it up. Most cells cannot take glucose up without that insulin signal or the insulin passport signal. So insulin decreases, all right, because we've given somebody, blood glucose decreases because we've given them some insulin right there. All right, now does it stay depressed? As we see, over time, blood glucose concentration now starts to increase again. And the reason why it does has nothing to do with the blood. It has to do with another organ in the body. Right? And so this is another example of extrinsic control, because it's not the blood that's regulating blood glucose. In this particular case, the liver is. And the liver can store sugar, can store glucose in particular. And as this blood glucose concentration dropped, the pancreas then stops secreting insulin because there's way too much there in the person. And it starts to secrete another hormone that you're probably not really familiar with yet. It's called glucagon. Glucagon is released from the pancreas when blood glucose drops, and glucagon goes to the liver, and it tells the liver to start secreting glucose into the blood. And as the liver secretes glucose into the blood, look what happens to blood glucose concentration. It goes up. Okay. And if this is a normal individual, it will reach the set point, and then the pancreas will stop secreting glucagon, and the blood glucose concentration will stay the same. Okay, or within this normal range. Okay, so for diabetes, there's different ways that we can help somebody. When somebody's blood glucose is too high, all right, if they are a type 1, type diabetic, insulin will help, because what does insulin do? It decreases. Yeah, it decreases blood glucose. All right, but that might not help some individuals in type 2 diabetes. So what the pharmaceutical treatments are for somebody with type 2, because insulin doesn't work for them, right? There are treatments that adjust how the liver functions so that the liver stops secreting glucose into the blood. So two different kinds of mechanisms, right? One kind of works through insulin, the other works through the mechanisms that glucagon works for. And we're going to become familiar with those kinds of the biochemistry involved with that. In the next couple chapters. Okay, so here is a list that you can't really appreciate in detail until the class is over, but I want you to know at least four important places where positive feedback is a natural and normal and beneficial feedback system to operate. Okay, remember, positive feedback is rare because it amplifies a change from normal and makes that change greater. It adds to the stimulus. But in this particular, these cases right here, it's important. So positive feedback works in producing blood clots, right? And what's another name for the production of blood clots? Coagulation. Yeah, coagulation. Because when you cut yourself and all of that precious tissue is flowing out of your body because blood is a fluid tissue, you think it's important to be able to seal that cut quickly, or can you wait around? No. Positive feedback can make something happen in a hurry. Okay? So that's one way to prevent blood loss through that positive feedback mechanism. We'll look and see where that is when we get into the blood. All right? And then in females, there is a big surge in luteinizing hormone that comes from the pituitary gland, and that causes ovulation. And this works through a positive feedback mechanism, and there is a nice couple video tutorials in Blackboard that you can watch to see how that happens. All right, so coagulation is one. Ovulation is the second one. Positive feedback is also important during parturition, when there is a positive feedback between the maternal circulation and the fetal circulation. Okay, oxytocin is secreted by the maternal pituitary, and it causes the uterus to contract. It's a very powerful, smooth muscle contraction. So the uterus contracts, and then the fetus or the baby that's about to be born, all right, what do they feel when the uterus contracts? Yeah, they feel confinement, right? So they're stressed because they can't run around and play soccer anymore, right? They're confined. They're stressed out. So they release some stress hormones, which then causes the mother to release more oxytocin, which causes more stress in the fetus, which causes more release of oxytocin. And how come the whole world just isn't filled up with oxytocin? What happens to stop that positive feedback cycle? Well, the baby's born, right? Then everything gets reset. So you can't go on forever in a positive feedback situation. Ooh, there's another one too. I should add that. And that is the milk letdown reflex is also works by positive feedback. Okay, and that works through oxytocin again. When a newborn baby starts to suckle, then there are sensors on the mother's breast that send signals to the hypothalamus to release oxytocin, and that stimulates release of milk from the breast. And then what happens to the infant? When there's nourishment there, they get excited, they suckle more, which causes more release of oxytocin. The infant suckles more oxytocin. And I guess I would have another question for you. How come the whole universe isn't filled up with breast milk if you have that positive feedback cycle happening? Well, because the breast only has a limited amount of milk, right? And then when the breast runs out of milk, the infant kind of falls asleep because they're no longer interested, and that resets the feedback mechanism. Okay. So you just might want to remember that one. I should add it to this list. Okay. The fourth example right here that we're going to look at in some detail in a couple chapters is the action potential. An action potential is a way that nerves send signals to each other and down axons. Okay, and in particular, the part of the action potential is depolarization. So we're going to look at detail at an action potential. So at least know these four terms. Positive feedback is normal for coagulation, ovulation, parturition, and depolarization. And maybe you don't know what depolarization is, but anybody that has gone through a physiology class will know exactly what you're talking about. It's not too mysterious for them. Okay, so here we have kind of like the baroreceptor reflex, which you guys talked about in lab. When you're lying down, okay, and you go to a standing position, there is always a drop in blood pressure. As a matter of fact, you all are sitting at your desks right now. When you stand up, even going from sitting to standing position, your blood pressure is going to drop. And that is going to be the stimulus. There are baroreceptors in the neck. There are some in the arch of the aorta right here that can monitor blood pressure. So they're going to measure a drop in blood pressure. That's the stimulus, right? The sensors are the baroreceptors in these locations. They send signals to the cardioregulatory center in the medulla. So the medulla is the integration center. I don't know if your book has all these different labels in it, so make sure you see where all these different labels go from that response loop. Right, and your blood pressure is dropping, so the medulla recognizes that there is an error because your blood pressure should not drop, and then it has to make what? A decision on what to do. Okay, so it can make a number of different choices, but it's going to send signals to the heart. All right, if your blood pressure is dropping, what would you guess that the medulla is telling the heart to do? Slow down or speed up in terms of heart rate? Speed up to pump more blood to boost your blood pressure. So here is a rise in blood pressure. And what's the relationship of this rise in blood pressure compared to the stimulus, which was a fall in blood pressure? Right? They subtract from each other, right? So this is a beautiful, nice negative feedback loop so that you don't pass out. Now, some people do pass out when they change body position. We call that orthostatic hypotension. That's kind of dangerous. And I'd hate to see anybody in here pass out when they stand up because what would happen? Well, they'd hit their head on the table and it would bounce off, and their head would bounce off the chair, and then their head would bounce off the floor, right? So it's really bad when that happens. Okay, so homeostasis is maintained. Now, the blood pressure, notice, is not absolutely constant. It can go up and down, but it only varies a little bit. All right? And it varies a little bit because the heart changes its activity. The heart is not constant, right? So everything is doing what? Dancing around each other to maintain homeostasis. Okay. So here is, do you have this slide? Okay. Control of blood glucose. All right, so here we should see the antagonistic mechanisms of two hormones, namely insulin and glucagon. All right, when you're eating, that's a particular state. We call that the fed state. There is food in your digestive tract, so you're absorbing nutrients from the digestive tract. And when you absorb glucose from the digestive tract, what happens to blood glucose? It goes up, all right? So that's the stimulus. And there are sensors in the pancreas, they're the islets of Langerhans, and they notice an increase in blood glucose. The response then is going to be the release of insulin from the pancreas. And insulin is a hormone, it's going to be transported to all cells in the body, and some cells have receptors for insulin. And as a result, those cells then start to take up glucose. So as they take glucose from the blood and put it in their cells, what happens to blood glucose then? It goes down as a result of that. All right, so blood glucose starts to go down, and how does that relate to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from it, so that's another nice, really cool negative feedback loop. All right, and then as the blood glucose concentration gets back more toward normal, then this insulin signal starts to go away, right? And that helps maintain homeostasis. Now, that mechanism would be pretty good all by itself, but there is something even niftier in this mechanism right here, because blood glucose is under antagonistic control. Not only is there a hormone from the pancreas that can decrease blood glucose, there is a hormone from the pancreas that can increase blood glucose if it goes the other way, right? So just like the brake and gas pedal in your car. So the other kind of state that you could be in besides the fed state is what we call the fasting state, right? So you haven't eaten anything in a while, like first thing in the morning, and in that particular case, you're not absorbing any glucose from the GI tract. And so what is going to be the tendency of blood glucose? If you can't absorb glucose from your digestive tract, blood glucose is going to decrease all by itself, right? Okay, so the pancreas can notice that decrease in blood glucose, and as a result will make a decision to secrete glucagon, and it's going to inhibit the release of insulin, because insulin does what? It decreases blood glucose. And if it decreased blood glucose, that would be positive feedback mechanism that's going to drive somebody away from homeostasis. So the insulin signal is going to go away, and the glucagon signal is going to increase. Glucagon does a number of things. Okay. Since insulin is going away, there's going to be a decrease in the cellular uptake of glucose. So cells won't take so much glucose out. That will have a tendency to maintain glucose in the blood if cells aren't taking it out. Glucagon, on the other hand, is going to work on the liver, and it's going to cause the liver to secrete glucose. There is a big compound in the liver called glycogen, and the basic building block of glycogen is glucose. And so when glycogen is in the blood, the liver basically just snips one glucose at a time off of glycogen, and it's able to secrete it into the blood. And when it does that, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes up. All right? And so what's the relationship between this response and the initial stimulus? They're negative, right? They subtract from each other, so we call that negative feedback. So that's what's going to help maintain normal blood glucose concentration. Okay. So that's homeostasis. So remember, homeostasis doesn't mean that every parameter is constant. It means that everything is changing, so nothing has to change by a lot. Because if something changes by a lot, well, that could cost you your life, right? Okay. All right. Next topic, chemistry. Ah, this is a fun part of the class. And let's see. Oh, well, let's end this right here. Good. We'll put this away. And let's see what we got right here. Okay, so I hope we're connected to the internet here. Back. Ooh, this is looking good. All right, so this week, everybody absolutely, positively, before you go home, has to assure themselves that you can get onto Blackboard, right? If you're not getting onto Blackboard, you got to see me this afternoon, except for those of you that haven't registered yet. You won't be able to get on until maybe tonight or maybe tomorrow morning. But if you would like to have a demo of Blackboard, because we've been looking at it, we've been snooping around, you can ask your lab instructor if you have lab this afternoon or me, okay? Okay, the only thing that I didn't get to because I forgot were the exam study guides. Some people have an extra button right here. Some sections don't have the exam study guides just yet. All right, but the lecture slides are in their course documents and was lecture two there for you guys. I hope so. All right, so you probably just want to download these things to your hard drive instead of always having to go to the web. So right-click on that, save target as, and that looks pretty good to me. Okay, we're downloading pretty fast. And here it is over here. Good. All right, so chemistry. I would spend a lot of time on chemistry because it's really fundamental to physiology. We said that anatomy was fundamental to physiology, but you know what? So is chemistry. So we're going to learn some physical chemistry in here so that we understand how a lot of physiologic systems work very nicely. All right, so we're going to even start with atoms. Look at some chemical bonds. We'll learn about four different kinds of chemical bonds. And then, of course, we have to spend some time with the pH scale to know something about acids and bases. And then we're going to finish up by talking about some of these four different kinds of organic molecules. So that's chemistry. All right, so atoms are the smallest units of matter. Remember, we want to start with something small and build up to something a little bit more complicated. All right, and they're composed of three kinds of subatomic particles. There are protons, neutrons, and electrons. Protons and neutrons are pretty big, and these can only be found in the nucleus. So in our course, we're going to use what we say is the solar system model for the atom, where there is a nucleus which kind of corresponds to the sun in our solar system, and then there are electrons that are in orbitals or shells, and those would correspond to the planets in the solar system, right? So that's the construct that I want you to have. And that's pretty elementary, but it works really nice in our class. So electrons are going to be found in orbitals and protons and neutrons inside the nucleus. Okay, and protons have an electrical charge on them of +1. And electrons, even though they're a lot smaller, they have an electrical charge which is exactly the same magnitude as the proton, but it's opposite. It's exactly -1. Because it's kind of funny how electrons and protons can actually, what do? They can completely cancel out electrical charge when they're together because they have the exact same magnitude. Okay? Okay, neutrons, on the other hand, don't have any kind of charge whatsoever. So here we have a hydrogen atom, and this is a hydrogen atom because it has one proton inside the nucleus. That's the definition for hydrogen atom. And we used to have a periodic table, but it got covered up by these really nice slides right here, screens. All right, maybe in a little bit I'll try to get a periodic table on this document viewer right here for you. Okay. And here is another element. It's different than hydrogen. This is what we call carbon. And what makes different elements different from each other is the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. And any kind of atom that has 6 protons inside the nucleus is always going to be called what?
Carbon.
It's always got to be called carbon, right? And any kind of atom that only has 1 proton inside the nucleus, it always has to be hydrogen, right? Okay. All right, so I want you to know the names of those particles and where you find them and the charge. All right, the other thing that really doesn't mean too much for us are these neutrons right here. They're only found in the nucleus as well. Well, what can you tell me about a proton and an electron? They have opposite charges. And since they have opposite charges, do they repel each other or do they attract each other? That's right. Opposite charges attract. All right, so these electrons want to combine with these protons and vice versa. Now, here we have a bunch of protons all jammed together inside the nucleus. And they don't like each other very much, right? Because the same charge likes to repel each other. Like charges repel. And so, because of that, that's why in nature there has to be neutrons that get placed into the nucleus right here just to make sure that all of those protons can coexist in the same small spot. That's the reason why they're there. And for physiology, that's really not too important. Right, for some kinds of medical imaging, maybe that's important, but in everyday physiology that we're going to consider, that is not so important. What is really important for you to know is the atomic number. All right, the atomic number is just the number of protons inside the nucleus. And as we change the number of protons inside the nucleus, guess what we are changing, or guess what is changing to that particular atom? It becomes a different element, right? So hydrogen has one, okay? Carbon has six. Oxygen is going to have a different number. Who knows what oxygen has? 16, okay? That's why we need that nice periodic table right here to tell us. You don't have to know, you don't have to memorize atomic number, but you should at least know that when you change the number of protons inside the nucleus, it becomes a different element, right? It's going to be silver or gold or carbon, silicon, sodium, or whatever. All right, so atomic mass I'm not so interested in because the atomic mass takes into account not just the number of protons, but the number of neutrons as well. What I want you to know is atomic number in here. All right, and if you have six protons inside the nucleus, in order to make this a nice neutral compound, how many electrons do you have to have? You should have six to make it neutral, right? Okay, and where do you find electrons? Outside the nucleus, and those places are called, you could use one of two names. You could call them orbitals, or you could call them shells. Okay, and these shells are arranged in a certain order. Here is the innermost shell or orbital, and in this orbital, by law, there can only be two electrons, right, this first orbital. The second orbital, you can have many more than two. As a matter of fact, you can go up to eight, and the atom becomes very stable when there are eight electrons in this outer shell. But of course, carbon doesn't, because how many electrons does carbon have? It's only got six, so it fills up the inner shell completely, right? And then there are only four left over to put in the outer shell, right? And that means that this carbon molecule, or this carbon atom, can undergo a number of chemical reactions, because chemical reactions are the result of interactions of electrons that are in the outermost shell with neighboring atoms. So another atom can come by and it can interact with these electrons right here. Right, so that this outer shell will be filled up with eight electrons, one way or the other. All right, that's when carbon becomes most stable, or actually all atoms become most stable when the outer shell is completely filled up with electrons. All right? Okay. So the number of shells is determined by the atomic number. Oh, what's the atomic number again in everyday language? It's the number of what? Number of protons inside the nucleus, right? And don't forget, first shell can only have two electrons, second shell can have eight, right? Electrons in more distant shells have higher energy. I don't know if we ever deal with that too much. But here is an important thing. The valence electrons are those that are in the outermost shell. And those, and only those, can participate in chemical reactions. So if we go here, and I have the cursor right here on these two electrons that are zooming around the nucleus, is this electron and this one over here, are these valence electrons? No, it's only in the outer shell. These four electrons in the outer shell are the valence electrons. Those are the ones that will participate in chemical reactions. Okay. Sometimes we use radioactive isotopes in medicine. These are high energy particles that that can be emitted from an unstable atom, and it's because of instability inside the nucleus because it doesn't have enough neutrons because of the atomic mass is not in equilibrium. All right, but that's all you have to know. So, in everyday work that we're going to do in here, and in reading the textbook, we're going to deal with a number of elements like sodium and potassium and phosphorus and magnesium, and these are really big long words. So there is a symbol that was designed to mean oxygen and carbon, and so you can just write C for carbon and we know exactly what you're talking about. We might even draw the structure of a molecule out, and the diagram would be way too complicated if we actually had to spell out that particular word. So we just use a simple symbol to represent these different elements right here. So the periodic table has many, many elements, and these are the only ones that I want you to know because these are the ones that are important biologically, right? So I want you to know that O stands for oxygen, right? And C stands for carbon, right? And let's see, Fe stands for iron, right? So some of these get a little bit tricky, right? Sometimes it's really simple. The first letter in the symbol, in the word, corresponds to the symbol, but not always. And for instance, sodium, the chemical symbol for sodium is Na, because in Greek, sodium is not sodium, it is natrium, right? So it has a little bit different form. Right, and the same thing for potassium. Where's potassium? The symbol for potassium is K because it's kalium in Greek. That's where these letters came from. You don't have to know that, but what you do have to know is K corresponds to potassium, right? And you don't have to know hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these symbols, but these you do because they're so important. We're going to be working with these, right? So CO is not chromium, that's cobalt. It's kind of funny. You need some cobalt. We'll talk about that later on. So here is a cheat sheet that you should practice because I'll be using these chemical symbols to give you some questions on the test. All right. Chemical bonds. Let's talk about some chemical bonds. An atom just has one nucleus and its associated electrons. Okay? And you can take a couple atoms, and if the arrangement is just right, they can join together through a chemical bond and form a molecule, right? So a molecule is composed up of many different kinds of atoms. And the electrons that are involved in forming chemical bonds are the valence electrons, the one in the outermost shell, right? The number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to complete the outermost shell. So if there are 7 electrons in the outermost shell, how many chemical bonds can that atom form? Only one, right? Because it wants 8. But if it has 6, it can undergo 2 chemical bonds because it's looking for 2 other electrons. Okay. So let's build a molecule out of 2 hydrogen atoms. So here's a hydrogen atom, and here is 1 proton inside the nucleus, and in orbitals, what are we going to find? 1 electron. But for that first orbital, how many electrons does hydrogen want to have? It's 2 in the first one, and then it's 8 in the subsequent shells, right? So this atom right here is most stable, most comfortable, when there are 2 electrons in its first shell right here. Well, it can bump into somebody that feels the same way, maybe, and that is another hydrogen atom with 1 proton, 1 electron. And when these come in close proximity with each other, the electron from this atom and the electron from this atom can range over this whole system right here. And when it does, it becomes a unit, it becomes a molecule. And in that particular circumstance, this nucleus feels like there are 2 electrons in its first shell, and this nucleus down here feels like it has 2 electrons in its first shell as well. Right, so it becomes very stable. We call this a nonpolar covalent bond because these electrons are shared equally between these 2 nuclei. Right, and so this is a covalent bond, and the key term that you should know for covalent bond, right, remember it has to do with these valence electrons, but what's happening with these valence electrons? Sometimes they're over here, sometimes they're over here, so these 2 nuclei share them. So the key term for covalent bond is sharing of electrons, right? Sharing of electrons. For instance, when we make hydrogen or oxygen molecules from two oxygen atoms. So here is a little chemistry nomenclature. H stands for hydrogen. And is this an atom or a molecule? And how on earth would you know? It's a molecule. How on earth did you know this is a molecule right here? Because the nomenclature, when there's a 2, a subscript 2 right here, it means that there are two atoms of hydrogen that are associated with each other through a covalent bond. Okay, and since you have two atoms, that's a molecule. The same thing for this oxygen. This is not oxygen atom, this is an oxygen molecule because I see two atoms put together. Okay, we're going to look at some compounds that are C6H12O6. Okay, and is that an atom or a molecule? That's a molecule because it has many atoms, right, making up that molecule. Okay, another kind of covalent bond are what we call covalent bonds. And let's build a water molecule. And you all know the chemical formula for water, right, even without taking a class like that. What's the chemical formula for water? H2O. And I don't know if you can see how to build a water molecule based on valence theory, but let's just go ahead and do it right now. So H2O, we got a H, here's the nucleus. How many protons in the nucleus? There's just one, and then one electron in an orbital someplace. So this hydrogen atom wants to find another electron someplace to fill up that shell. Okay. And here's my periodic table. Oxygen has 16 protons inside the nucleus. That's what defines what oxygen is, right? 16. So here we have the nucleus with 16 protons inside there. So let's fill up the shells with how many electrons? Well, oh, but it's got 16 protons in there. Let's start at the very beginning. It's got to have 16. Yeah, it's got to have 16 electrons. Okay. Oh, oxygen is 8. Oh, I was reading the wrong number. I was reading atomic mass. Okay. Yes, oxygen is 8. Okay, so let's put some electrons in here. This first orbital right here, how many electrons go in it? That's 2. How many are left? There's 6 that are left. All right, so here's 1, okay, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 6. Now, how many, so this is oxygen, right? So how many electrons does this oxygen want to get from someplace to get 8? It needs 2. Well, it gets 1 from this hydrogen, right, because this orbital can come over here, and these can be shared. What kind of bond is that when these electrons are shared? That's a covalent bond. Here can be another hydrogen, right, that's over here, and it's got, what, one electron in an orbital. These two electrons will be shared with this atom and the oxygen atom, and now the hydrogen feels like it's got 2, this hydrogen feels like it has 2 in its first shell, and the valence shell for oxygen is completely filled up with 8 electrons, so this is a nice stable molecule. Okay, so you might just kind of want to draw that out sometime. Your book sort of goes through that. Okay, now here is something that is very, very important. When we looked at the covalent bond between two hydrogens to make a hydrogen molecule, we said that was nonpolar. Those electrons could flow anywhere over the two hydrogen atoms. They shared the electrons equally. But certain elements, and oxygen is one of them, get very, very greedy with electrons. They're highly electronegative. They have a tendency to draw electrons to themselves. And when they draw electrons to themselves, guess what happens to this nucleus over here, the hydrogen nucleus? It's left without an electron floating around it. Okay? So on this end of the molecule, there's a little bit of a positive charge. Because what's the charge of a proton in there? Positive. All right? And the charge of this proton over here is positive, right? Just a little bit of a charge, so we just give it a little sigma right here. And since you have 8 protons in the nucleus of this oxygen, right, and now what have you got? You got 10 electrons floating around it. This end of the molecule is a little bit what? More electrons than protons. This end of the water molecule is a little bit negative. And we just kind of give it that little symbol right there. All right, so this negative charge will completely cancel out these two positive charges. So if we look at this molecule from way in the back of the room, what's the overall charge on the molecule? Okay. Okay, these two charges cancel out this one right here. They're exactly equal. They're tiny, tiny charges. So if you're far away and look at this water molecule, it looks neutral. Overall, the water molecule is neutral. But now you start walking down the stairs and you get closer to the water molecule and you walk up on the water molecule from this direction. What do you see first, a neutral molecule or a little bit of a positive charge? You see a little bit of a positive charge. Or if you walk up on the water molecule from this direction right here, what do you see? A little bit of a negative charge. And, okay, what can you tell me about these opposite charges? They have a tendency to cancel each other out. So if what's walking up upon this molecule right here is another H2O molecule, how is it going to associate with this first one right here? Is an oxygen molecule going to be pulled into this oxygen, or is the end that has the hydrogen? Well, because here's a positive, another water molecule will associate over here by that hydrogen atom. So even though that water molecule is absolutely neutral, it has little areas that have little bits of charge to it. And because one end of the water molecule is negative and the other end is positive, we say it is polar. All right, so if you look at the end of something, maybe like a baseball, is a baseball polar, that round thing. There's nothing different about the top or the bottom or the sides. It's exactly the same. That's nonpolar. Now, what about the Earth, which is kind of like a baseball, but a little bit bigger? Is it polar? It's polar because on the top, there's a magnetic field that's positive, and on the bottom, there's a magnetic field that's negative. So in terms of magnetism, it's different on the top and the bottom. So if you have something that's different on the top and the bottom, we call it polar. Okay, so yeah, the world is polar. Water molecules are polar. Water molecules are not polar in terms of magnetism, but because of this little electrical charge right here. Okay, so, and that's due to this oxygen right here. There are some elements that are similar to oxygen in that sense. Right, and those, okay, are nitrogen and phosphorus, and probably you could think of sulfur as well, but oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus. So anytime you have an oxygen bound to a hydrogen right here, or a nitrogen bound to a hydrogen, it's going to produce little areas of charge, okay, and they will become polar molecules. So here we have water. And is that polar or nonpolar? It's polar because of that oxygen right there. And if we have a glass of water, you got billions and billions and billions, trillions and trillions and trillions of these molecules in that solution right there. Is that going to be a polar liquid or a nonpolar liquid? Because it's only made up of polar compounds, right? It's going to be a polar liquid. So anything that has little charges associated with it can dissolve in water very nicely. So various ions can dissolve in water. There are other compounds that are made up of nonpolar chemical bonds, like oils and fats and things like that. They can't dissolve in water because they don't have any charge associated with them, right? So they don't even care if water's there or not. They won't even pay attention to them, and so they can't dissolve in water. All right, so polar molecules have a nice tendency to be able to dissolve in water. Okay, let's talk about another kind of bond. Then I'll put these couple of things together. The strongest bond is a covalent bond. A next weaker kind of bond is an ionic bond. And ionic bonds are a result of some interaction between electrons in two atoms. And where would those electrons be? The outer shell. It's always going to be the outer shell, okay, an ionic bond. So here we have a nucleus, and this is going to be the sodium atom. And if we look at a periodic table, we're going to see, oh, I need to be able to project this. I just don't want to take time to show it on the document camera. I'll make sure I can do that next time. It has 11 protons inside the nucleus. Now, what I want to know from you is, what do we call that, the 11 protons inside the nucleus? Is that the atomic mass or the atomic number? That's the atomic number. The atomic number is the number of protons inside the nucleus, okay? And if we add the number of neutrons to it, then that's the atomic mass. But I'm not so concerned about that. I want you to become familiar with the atomic number, because that's what determines what element it is and what kind of chemistry it can undergo. So sodium, and don't forget, the abbreviation for sodium is capital N, little a. All right, it has 11 protons. So how many electrons does it have? It has 11. So let's fill up the orbitals. 2 in the first shell. Okay, so that leaves 8. Okay, and then there's, okay, then there's 8 in the next shell over here, so that's 10. And so since it has 11 protons, it has one extra electron in the outermost shell. What do we call that outermost shell once again? The valence shell. All right, so what does sodium want to do? Well, it needs 7 electrons to fill up the outer shell. What's easier? Well, let's just get rid of 1. Okay, and then the next outer shell is all filled up and sodium will become very stable. So it's a lot easier to get rid of that one than to find 7 other electrons to fill up the outer shell. Okay, so that is sodium. There's another element, that is chlorine. And chlorine has 17 protons inside the nucleus. So that means it has 17 electrons in all of its orbitals. And how do we start filling up the orbitals? 2 in the first shell, 8 in the second, so that's 10. All right, so that means there's 7 electrons left over in the outer shell right here. And how many does it really want to have in this outer shell? 8. 8. But it's looking for 1 to fill it up. Guess who it can get 1 electron from? The sodium right here. Really easy to do. So when these two atoms come close to each other, okay, in an atomic distance scale, they have to be really close to each other, this electron from sodium will hop over to this chlorine atom and fill the chlorine outermost shell with 8 electrons, and then sodium in its outer shell right here only has 8, and then this becomes a really stable pair. It forms what we call an ionic bond. Because now, what do we have in this area right here? Do we have electrical neutrality in this area right here? We have 11 protons, but only how many electrons? Okay, only 10. So there's one extra proton. So you have one extra positive charge. So here's a nice positive charge over here. And what about chlorine? It's got one extra electron compared to the number of protons inside the nucleus, right? It's got 18 electrons and only 17. So what is going to be the overall charge of this atom here? Going to be negative. So we got a positive and a negative. And what's the relationship between positive and negative? They attract each other. So sodium and chloride will form a bond, but it's called an ionic bond. All right? And so sodium is left as with a positive charge, chlorine with a negative charge. Ionic bonds compared to covalent bonds are relatively weak. They can be broken pretty easily. And you're aware of that because you have sodium chloride at home. And if you were to take some sodium chloride and put it in a glass of water, what would happen to it? The bonds are actually going to break and it's going to dissolve and go into solution. Doesn't take a lot of energy. The last concept, oh, where's the sign-in sheet at? Yeah, keep passing it around quick. Thank you. Okay. When an atom has a charge on it, we call that an ion. We can also call it something else. We can call it an electrolyte. All right. And so what about this chlorine right here? Is that an ion or an electrolyte? Yes, it is, because there is that little negative charge. Anytime there's an electrical charge on an atom, it's an ion. Sodium is an ion. But is sodium the same kind of ion as chlorine? No, one is positive and one is negative, so we have to develop a little bit more language to describe the difference. If it has a positive charge, it's a cation. If it's a negative charge, we call it an anion. And I think I had an instructor draw this for me one time. Let's see if I can remember how to do it. Okay. Here we have. What's this? Yeah, it looks kind of like a devil. These are whiskers. And here's a little mouth right here. That's a cat. Okay? And here is the cat looking at you. So that's a cation. Okay? An anion will be what? Negative. All right, the next time we're going to talk about is when we get back next time. Some ions have more than one charge, two charges. I want you to know what that is called.